Welcome to episode 45 of The Climate Champions. I'm Lee Krivat, and each week I publish a new episode with a new climate champion as my guest. This week's guest is New York State Senator Kevin Parker, chair of the Energy and Telecommunications Committee in the New York State Senate. If you or someone you know is a climate champion, please let me know at www.krivatenergyinnovations.com. Like myself, Senator Kevin Parker is a product of the New York City public school system. He attended PS 193, Andrews HUD Intermediate School 240, and Midwood High School. Elected to the New York State Senate in 2002, Senator Parker is committed to restoring the overall quality of life for the constituents of the 21st Senate District in Brooklyn. As a lifelong Brooklyn resident, he has been a Flatbush resident for more than 31 years, nurtured, educated, and employed in the borough. Senator Parker is intimately familiar with the needs of the 21st District, which consists of many diverse communities: Flatbush, East Flatbush, Midwood, Ditmas Park, Kensington, Windsor Terrace, and Park Slope. If you want an unprecedented opportunity to connect with key stakeholders and explore what's next in the utility sector, join me at GridConnects in Washington, D.C., December 10th through 12th. I'll be recording an episode of The Climate Champions live the morning of the 10th with Miguel Romero, Vice President at San Diego Gas and Electric, followed by world-class experts exploring diverse perspectives and uncovering market innovations poised to redraw the electric utility landscape. Secure your spot at GridConnects by registering now at GridConnects, and that's an X, not a C, .com. Senator Parker's professional background reflects a wide range of public service and an unwavering commitment to a better New York. His commitment to his community is reflected in his leadership in civic organizations, such as the formation of the New York Ready Emergency Preparedness Unit alongside other community leaders. Senator Parker's commitment to education has taken him into the classroom as a professor of both African American studies and political science at several colleges within the City and State University of New York's higher education systems. Senator Parker teaches a majority of his classes and is a faculty advisor to student organizations and activities at Brooklyn College. Welcome to The Climate Champions. I'm Lee Krivat. I'm here in Brooklyn with New York State Senator Kevin Parker, Chair of the Energy and Telecommunications Committee in the New York State Senate. Senator, welcome to The Climate Champions.
Thanks, Lee. I appreciate you having me on.
Can you talk a little bit about your motivating moment when you first decided you had to get engaged in the fight against climate change?
Absolutely. Lee, as you know, I represent the 21st District in Brooklyn, which is part of Flatlands and Canarsie, but principally Flatbush and East Flatbush, Midwood, Ditmas Park, Windsor Terrace, and Park Slope. You know, I don't think I came to this thing thinking about climate change. I'm 52 years old, grew up in New York City public schools, and I remember growing up as a child of the 70s that we learned a lot about conservation at that time, right? There used to be a time in which the New York Thruway is beautiful now, but it used to be a time when you would drive down the New York Thruway and there would be a wake of garbage behind your car. You know, we had to literally learn, like, not to litter on the highway, right? Not to throw stuff out the window.
It's a good thing from a climate change perspective that we did learn not to litter.
Yes, absolutely. But also, like, to turn off lights, right? To turn the water off as you brush your teeth. The beginnings of our conversations around recycling began during that time. And so I think that this notion of protecting the planet and, you know, being good stewards of our environment was something that I literally learned, I guess, growing up. In 2003, when I got elected and took office, I became the ranking member of the Energy and Telecommunications Committee in the Senate. At the time, the Republican Party was in charge, so they controlled the county agenda, and there was not any legislation on there that actually dealt with the issues around climate change. In 2004, we started the Democratic Task Force on Sustainable Energy, and I became the chair of that task force. And at that time, then began the work of developing an agenda around sustainable energy in the state of New York and thinking about how do we, in fact, create a clean energy economy.
Why is climate change mitigation personally important to you?
Climate change mitigation is personally important to me because we all have family members and I live on this planet too. And I really would love to live in a place that I think is going to be sustainable and long lasting. It scares me to think that the children in my family, even my own children, will not have an opportunity to kind of live in a place where you have resources, where you're worrying about water and you're worrying about the air and worrying about flooding. And so I think for me, it's very much about being a good steward of the planet such that we pass on a legacy of a planet that's sustainable and that can sustain us. Because literally, this planet will expel us, right? We're in the process right now of this planet deciding that if it can't operate the way it's supposed to operate, that it will make it unlivable for us, the ones who are making it toxic. You know, so I think it's important for us to kind of learn that, and more importantly, to pass those lessons on to the next generation.
I feel like the big question is, will it expel us faster than we could deal with it and stay here?
I hope not, right? Like, I'm really hoping that we get our act together and quick. And when I say we, I mean the human race, right? And I think that when we look at the issues around climate change, it's corny and it's cliche, but we have to think globally but act locally, right? And it's really about not just individual actions, about how we all operate as individuals, but how our communities operate, how our cities, how our states operate. Ultimately, though, how our nations operate. And so it's going to be important for not just New York City to lead the way, as we are with our Climate and Community Protection Act, the CCPA, that we just passed, the most aggressive climate protection legislation in the history of the United States. But hopefully that will be a model for what the whole country will get to. And then eventually that will be something that will be agreed upon between other nations.
We were kind of there for a while, where all the nations, for the most part, agreed based on the Paris Accord.
Yeah, I mean, the Paris Accord was great. I mean, and the biggest achievement was the fact that they got to an agreement, right? That was kind of the beginning. And we also understood that that was the beginning of the conversation. It really, what we weren't even where we need to be. Then the first thing your president does is that he backs out of the accords. What do we do about that?
You're calling him my president? He's the country's president.
Okay,
right now.
All right. He's not my president, so I'll just...
I understand your point.
He's somebody's president.
Speaking of that, because he has called it a hoax, climate change, when you meet people that have that perspective that it maybe it's a hoax or that the scientific data isn't accurate, how do you convince them otherwise?
I don't argue climate change with people, to be honest with you. I mean, we're all entitled to our opinions, but we're all not entitled to our own facts. And the reality is that the notion of climate change, right? And people need to understand the difference between temperature and climate, right? Today is about 65 degrees in New York City. That's the temperature. Climate is what the temperature is over the week, over the month, over the year, over the decade, right? And it's not about what the temperature is on any particular day. It also includes things like catastrophic weather or extreme weather that we may see. Firestorms, cyclones, tornadoes, hurricanes, things like that, right? And so the reality is that the science is there. If people are not convinced, then I don't know what to tell them, to be honest with you. I don't try to convince them of that. I really try to spend most of my time thinking through ways that we can work together to move our environment forward. Because I think even the people who are not convinced by climate change understand the economic realities of where our energy is going and energy development and generation is going. And many times they're convinced that they need to be engaged on that end. But I just don't think that it's worth kind of getting into long debates with people about whether climate change is real or not.
Can you talk about what you do in your role as the chair of the Energy and Telecommunications Committee?
Yeah, absolutely. As the chair of the Energy and Telecommunications Committee in the Senate, I oversee a broad range of assets and organizations related to both the energy sector and the telecommunications sector, both private assets as well as public assets. And so in the state of New York, it is utilities like National Grid and Con Ed, dealing with organizations like the ISO, which oversees the grid in the state of New York, dealing with the Power Authority, as well as NYSERDA, the New York State Research, Energy, and Development Agency, as well as the PSC, the Public Service Commission, which is the agency that regulates our utilities here in the state of New York. And I do the same thing on the other side as it relates to telecom as well. And so I work with those private companies, agencies, and the bureaucrats who run those agencies to try to figure out what laws we should be passing in the state legislature in order to achieve whatever the various goals are. And sometimes it may be more generation. Sometimes it may be the kind of generation we're producing or providing more generation or better generation or more access to energy in a particular geographic area in the state of New York.
What are you seeing as some of the impacts of climate change right now?
Well, I mean, the impacts of climate change are pretty apparent from what I'm seeing. You're seeing it both on kind of a micro level, but then also on a larger level, right? So you'll see things like cancer clusters. You'll see things like asthma, right? And other kinds of allergies, you know, seasonal allergies are on the rise. Asthma's on the rise in many communities. Particularly, you know, you see a lot of those impacts in Black and Latino communities where a lot of the, you know, the generators are located. Some of the peaker plants and those kind of things are located and creating these things. But then you see it within the context of droughts in places like Texas and California, forest fires that we can't put out in California, places flooding because of the rise in the ocean in places like Miami. I just came back from Bangladesh. There's ground zero for climate change and looking at the problems they have there. And there's really a significant geopolitical impact. You know, Bangladesh is dealing with a huge refugee crisis right now. But then they themselves may become refugees if we're not able to stem the tide around rising water and some of the other problems that we're having. If things keep going the way that they're going right now, we're not able to lower the mean temperature of the earth. You're going to have places in the Middle East over the next probably 30 or 40 years that will become literally uninhabitable for maybe the populations that live there now. Whole nations of people that are going to need to be relocated. And places that will not be able to feed themselves, that will become so arid that you will not be able to produce water there. And, you know, salinization plants and all the other tricks that we're using now are not going to work. And so this is a real crisis, probably the biggest crisis that the earth is facing, and it's going to affect every single person. It's going to affect people from on high and everyday people who are just trying to make their way in the world. And so it's important that we kind of address it. And then, like, again, it's corny and cliche, but you know, you got to think globally and act locally. And so we see these impacts, and in the state of New York, we're really working hard to try to mitigate them and trying to do our part to provide some leadership on where we think the country should be going.
I know that New York has a goal by 2050 to be greenhouse gas free. And sometimes I wonder if that's soon enough. What do you think about 2050 as the goal?
Well, again, as you know, the state of New York in the last legislative session passed the most aggressive climate protection legislation in the history of the United States. We lovingly called it the CCPA, the Community and Climate Protection Act, that really gets us to a place of being carbon neutral by 2050, which gives us about 30 years to get our act together and to be producing energy as clean as we can, but then also mitigating sources of CO2 and particulate matter as well. I hope that it's soon enough. When I look at the issues around climate change, it is not something we're going to solve, unfortunately, just in the state of New York, right? But we're really in the state of New York trying to provide some leadership about what we believe can happen in the rest of this nation. And right now, having a commander in chief who doesn't believe in climate change is holding us back. But we're hoping that other states will follow our lead and put in their own climate protection acts in, and then eventually, hopefully, we'll have a change in administration and elect somebody, you know, who understands this. But we'll build with places like India, China, and the European Union to get maybe another level of the Paris Accords that get us in place, because this is a global phenomenon. And, you know, as they say about the U.S., you know, we might have got here in different ships, but we're all in the same boat right now. And unless we're able to not just stem the tide, but turn around the direction that we're quickly going into, we're going to be off the cliff before we know it.
Well, that was humbling. Can you talk about some setbacks you've had in your life?
Yes, but I don't think about things that have happened in my life, honestly, as setbacks. I think they've all been learning experiences, and I very much believe in the notion of destiny. I consider myself a son of destiny, and that, you know, we're all trying to kind of do the things that the best we can, and mistakes are made, and you just try to move on. A quote from one of my favorite movies is, "Why do you fall?" And it's so you can learn to get up. And the big thing that I've tried to do in my career is, despite the circumstances, just to kind of move forward and kind of learn from the experiences that I have, both good and bad. I've had some things that have not gone really well. Sometimes my relationships with my colleagues, sometimes the relationship with the governor, other things. But I never stopped serving my community during those periods. Continue to kind of do the work and kind of push through. And then, you know, hopefully I've emerged and grown as a person. Being in public life as long as I have been, now going on my 18th year, is a very humbling experience because your life is very transparent. And so when you have great victories, people see, but when you have setbacks, people see those things as well. And it's the gift and the curse because you can literally talk to anybody, but then anybody can feel like they can say whatever they want to say to you as well. And you're expected to have to be able to take it with a smile, which I don't always do. But I think that I've grown both as a man and as a person in this position and continue to both do the best I can as a person, but also as a public servant, but also to, in the context, continue to serve my community and provide the things that I think my community needs.
Can you talk about your prior background before the Senate?
Yes. Before I got elected to the Senate, I actually spent most of my professional life working in government and politics. I have a degree from Penn State University in public service. I have a master's degree in urban policy and management from the New School for Social Research. I've worked for the city council, the Manhattan Borough President's Office. I worked for the first Governor Cuomo and had a stint actually even as a lobbyist for a large investment bank, Payne Webber, which is now owned by UBS. But really kind of got my biggest exposure in politics working for Hillary Clinton on her campaign. Everybody's familiar with the famous listening tour. I was actually one of the advanced people who went around the state with her organizing those events. And that was a tremendous opportunity.
So when you say Hillary Clinton, you mean her run for Senate,
when she became the senator.
Yeah.
I was honored to really have an opportunity to work closely with her and learn from her a lot about politics and about policy. And in fact, our mayor was the campaign manager. People forget that. But Bill de Blasio was the campaign manager for Hillary Clinton during that time. So go back with him and a number of other people since those days. And then I worked for a guy named H.R. McCall, who just recently retired from chair of the board of the State University of New York, which is the largest higher education, public education system in the country. And prior to that, he was actually the New York State Comptroller, first African-American elected statewide. I was his deputy director of government affairs, where I helped organize his political union and community contacts in New York City and the suburbs and surrounding suburbs. And that was a great experience as well. But I also did a number of things kind of on the local level. I was a member of my community board, Community Board 17, for a number of years. The parliamentarian, I was the second vice chair of the youth committee, chair of the education committee. Sat on the board of Nazareth Regional High School for a while. Sat on the board of NHS of East Flatbush, which now has become NHS of, that's Neighborhood Housing Services, a housing organization, sat on their board. Was on the 67th Precinct Council as a member there. So I did a lot of community work as well. So I've experienced politics from a lot of different ways that helped prepare me to run for office and to serve my community in the way that I have.
You and I share the fact that we both grew up in Brooklyn. I've always considered it a great place to be brought up. It was challenging, but it roughened me up a bit and made me able to deal with things. Can you talk about your youth and growing up?
Absolutely. I think I've been extremely, it was like the same way you do, extremely fortunate having to grow up in Brooklyn. And you're right, it's a mixed bag, right? Because being a Brooklyn kid can be rough, can be very, very rough. But also just your exposure to people and things is just absolutely incredible. When I was born, my parents lived in the Bushwick Projects. I grew up there until I was about 9, and then they bought a house and I moved to where I live now. And I've been living in that house probably about 44 years, 45 years, something like that. And went to elementary school right in the neighborhood. I went to PS1A3, Huddy, went to Midwood High School, all right in the neighborhood. Most of those schools, actually two of the schools are in my district. And so it's been good because I've went to school with kids who were Irish and Italian and Indian and Pakistani and kids from the Caribbean. One of my best friends, he was Puerto Rican, but he grew up in Brazil. It was just like a wide range of kids, kids from China, kids from Thailand, like just met people from everywhere, right? And it's kind of interesting when I meet people from another country who did not have that kind of background. And I think just thought that was really interesting. And then you have a broad range of cultural institutions in Brooklyn, even going back into the 70s and 80s when I was growing up, places like the Muse Museum, the Brooklyn Children's Museum, the Brooklyn Museum. We had all of those things right here, Coney Island, this a wide array of just access. And then things are obviously happening in Manhattan. But in Brooklyn, we never felt like we were in lack of anything. And I think that was really important for me. And then I think Brooklyn is a great sense of community, always. Like, people always like, why are you always, like, I never say I'm from New York, I always say I'm from Brooklyn. Like, no matter where I am, right? I just came back from Bangladesh and I introduced myself, I'm from Brooklyn. And I'm like, because people know where Brooklyn is, right? Like, people know New York City, but people know Brooklyn. Like, let's not act like people don't. They may not know other places, but they know Brooklyn. And so I've been very proud of that. But as I said, there's been rough times too, both in the context of you grew up in the projects and there's, you know, there's crime and other things that happened there. But it's also a big transition when I moved from, again, a primary Black and Latino community in the Bushwick Projects to Flatbush, and I was the second Black family on the block. And there was a group of white kids who used to chase me home every day, right? And so, like, it all wasn't peaches and cream, but the world isn't. And so I think that it very much taught me how to stand my ground. But then also, sometimes when it's important to run home and then learn to fight another day. But I would never trade my raising in Brooklyn for the world. I look back on it with a lot of fondness, and it's been a pleasure to have the opportunity to represent this borough in the way that I have. I represent a district that includes Prospect Park, the Botanical Gardens, the Brooklyn Museum, the Brooklyn Public Library, right? Grand Army Plaza. And so it's been just really interesting. And like I said, great to be able to work with the leaders of those institutions to make sure that the young people of this great borough have the same access to the resources that I had growing up.
You know, you're choking me up a little bit here, because when I was a kid, my parents took me to those places and I remember them. When I ran the Brooklyn Half a few years ago, you get to run past a lot of those places. And then you come out on Coney Island and you're on the ocean. It truly is an amazing place. New York.
It really is. It really is. People should come visit.
Can you talk about your biggest successes, the successes you're most proud of?
Yes. I mean, I would actually begin with just the notion of getting elected. Just a huge thing for my family. I come from just a very regular family. Sometimes people think I come from some kind of storybook thing, some kind of Cosby Show reality, and I don't. My father was born an orphan in 1932 in Harlem Hospital. He used to say that it was so bad in 1932 that rats were kicking over garbage cans, eating onions, and crying like babies. I'm not sure what it meant, but he used to say it all the time.
I'm trying to figure it out right now.
But it was just rough times, right? It was the middle of the Depression, and here he's an African-American boy who's an orphan during the middle of, at that time, was the greatest downturn of, you know, of the American economy. My mother had come from a large family in Norfolk, Virginia. And she was the second oldest of 10 children, and her older sister was very sick. And so she had to help my grandmother escape my abusive grandfather. And they literally left in the middle of the night and took a bus up to New York. And that's how, you know, my mother wound up in New York. And like I said, I was born in the Bushwick Projects. And my mother was a clerk at Brooklyn College for a number of years. She worked there for 44 years and retired as the assistant registrar at Brooklyn College. My father worked for transit and started out as a station cleaner, rose through the ranks and became a conductor and a motorman, and eventually retired as a dispatcher after 29 years of working there. And so they were regular people. And I think they were super surprised when I said I was going to run for office. I don't think they ever thought I would actually win. And so I think, just if you ask me, one of my biggest accomplishments, just the notion that I could be a success story that comes out of my own personal family in that way. And I think, you know, they're both deceased now, but I like to believe that they were proud of me and the fact that I was able not just to rise to the level of being elected, but that it was something that I wanted to do and I was persistent enough to actually reach it. And by the way, in 2003, when I took the oath of office, I was actually the youngest member of the state Senate. Right. I was at 34. The mean age was much higher than it is now. But I was the youngest member of the Senate. So I think a big deal. And I look legislatively and I think that we've done a couple of things that I'm very, very proud of. And I won't go through all of them. But two things that I think of legislatively. One is a clinic access bill that we passed that raised penalties on people who attack doctors and nurses and other people who are working in clinics that provide abortions. I think that was really important around protecting a woman's right to choose. And the second thing is, I was the author of a bill on the green collar jobs, which we have something in the state of New York That's actually a multi-state compact called REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. It's a cap and trade program around carbon. And we have a fund here in the state of New York. And I created a bill that took $113 million of those dollars and used it over 5 years to retrofit 1 million homes. I'm hoping that in this next coming legislative session that we'll do a second round of that. And this is important for three reasons. One, when you retrofit homes, you lower your carbon footprint. You lower the energy prices of the home that you retrofitted. And you create full-time jobs at a living wage with benefits, right? And so all three are important things that we need to do, not just in the context of climate change, but also within the context of building a clean energy economy here in the state of New York. And then the third thing is that I was able, I always say that my job is two parts. Half of it is legislative and the other half is leadership. And I would say with the context of the leadership part is that a number of years ago, I worked with Senator Chuck Schumer and at that time, Congressman Ed Towns, and created a small business development center at Brooklyn College in my district. And I thought that was important, again, within the context of building full-time jobs at a living wage with benefits, particularly for women and Black and Latino businesses. One of the issues is access to capital and technical assistance. The Small Business Development Center actually would help people, because you know what we have in our community are people who know how to cook food, don't know how to run restaurants, people who can build a table, but don't know how to sell furniture. And then even if they can get those things going, oftentimes they can't get the access to capital they need to actually get their business to the level of being profitable. And so Small Business Development Center, which still exists at Brooklyn College, was an important step to getting that done. And so I'm very, very proud of those things.
That's super exciting. Can you talk about your vision for the future with respect to climate change? Where do you think the world will be in 20, 30 years?
I hope in 20 or 30 years that we're much further along than we are at this point, right? I think that hopefully we'll have a national agenda that will make the CCPA that we just passed obsolete and seem like a thing of the past. I'm hoping that we get there very quickly. There's some really big things that need to be done around the nation, but here in the state of New York, even in the context of, let's say, our CCPA. I'll just mention three things that are really important. We have over 2 million cars in the state of New York. We're going to have to essentially electrify all of those vehicles in order to kind of get to our goal. It sounds oxymoronic, but we're going to use less energy by using more electricity. Right, we're going to use less energy by using more electricity. And electrifying cars or getting cars off of fossil fuels is going to be a big part of what we do. We cannot, in fact, achieve our goal unless we convert every single car in the state of New York over the next 30 years. So that's a short amount of time to do that. And I'm talking about not just passenger vehicles, but also delivery trucks. We're talking about farm vehicles. All those things are going to have to be converted to clean energy sources, right? Second is we're going to have to retrofit almost all of our homes and businesses, right? We're New York, for the context of the United States, is an old state, and we have old buildings. And so we're going to have to retrofit those buildings to make sure that they are keeping in the heat during the winter and keeping in the cold during the summer months. And I think those two things are going to be incredibly important. The most important thing is that we're going to have to teach people to change our behavior, right? We're going to have to teach people demand response and to have them just understand when they should be washing their clothes, right? And stuff like that, when they should be using electricity and kind of understanding what peak and off peak and peak demand times are. And I mean, literally, we're going to have to teach people that. I'm actually going to be putting in a bill this year that is going to essentially create a task force to create a curriculum that we put in our schools, because I think we have to start with our young people. Because I think, you know, if you have kids, you always know, like, kids will always, like, correct parents once they learn something.
I don't know. I know this stuff pretty well. So I went on a demand response time of use rate.
Right.
And I had to still run after my kids. And my kids are into climate change mitigation. They understand, but I still had to shut the lights behind them.
Yes, but did they learn it in school?
No, I tried to teach them.
Right, yeah. And that's what I'm saying. I think it's a different thing when they have to learn it in school, because then they're trying to come home and teach their lessons, right? And so, but I think it's going to take a lot, right? So I think, you know, you doing what you're doing at home is actually great and admirable, and I wish more parents did that kind of thing. But I think we're also going to need to teach it in school. I think we're going to need some PSAs. I think we're really going to have to focus on teaching our citizenry the notion of demand response and what it and time of use and all those things is going to be very, very important. No one is really talking about it, but it's one of the biggest goals that we're going to have going forward if we're, in fact, really going to deal with the issue of climate change in our city and our state.
You started this conversation, I think, by talking about the Earth expelling humans if we don't get our act together. So do you think that's going to happen, or are we going to be fine?
I'm hoping that we're going to be fine. You know, I'm a big movie buff, right? So I keep thinking like we could really wind up like Road Warrior, right? Like Mad Max, you know, Beyond Thunderdome. Or there's a really good movie called Icepiercer. I don't know if you ever see this movie, where like essentially climate change has hit us. The whole world is essentially in a frost, but this guy has built this train that's literally just going around the earth. And it's a whole class thing where like rich people on the front of the train and poor people in the back of the train. It's really kind of interesting. And I also think about the 70s, like you had a bunch of kind of post-apocalyptic movies. One of my favorites, Soylent Green, right? You know the secret about Soylent Green, right?
Yes.
It's people, right? I mean, you know, like these are real things, right? Like we laugh about it now, but like you could get to a place where we don't have food. I think the most poignant part of the Soylent Green movie, which is, you know, Charlton Heston's in it, is like he goes to some rich person's house and he's a police officer and he absconds, leaves the house and takes an apple with him. And he goes home and he's like with this guy, older guy who's like his mentor, and they're like sharing this apple. And like, and this guy's like, oh my God, I haven't seen an apple since I was young. Like, he's an older man, like in his 70s. He's like, oh, I haven't seen an apple in 30 years. We could be at that place. And so I'm really hoping that we beat the clock. And I know that I'm doing my part. And I know that many of my colleagues in the state legislature are very determined to make sure that in the state of New York that we beat the clock. But also, more importantly, become an example and a leader for the nation. And so that, again, we have to think globally and act locally. And certainly I commend members of Congress and others who are trying to push the federal administration and laws of the United States to kind of get to that place. But as I said before, ultimately, this is going to be something that has to be agreed upon by the U.S., China, India, Russia, right? The European Union are going to all have to come together and develop a set of understandings and some cooperation, more importantly. Well, this is a problem. The good news, though, is that developing a clean energy economy is actually an economic opportunity. And so there's really an opportunity for people to make money, improve their lot in life, learn skills, because these are things that people are gonna, and I remind people that green collar jobs are nothing but blue and white collar jobs with a green purpose. And so you're gonna need accountants, and you're gonna need scientists, and you're gonna need marketing people, but you're also gonna need plumbers and electricians and carpenters to do the work in retrofitting buildings. You're gonna need people to do energy audits, right? You're gonna need people to do economic and quantitative analysis around this stuff. So there's a whole economy that's gonna be built around clean energy. Part of my goal as the chair is to see New York be a leader in that clean energy economy.
Do you have any questions for me?
What made you do this podcast and get involved in being a climate champion?
I was in the energy industry and I was very attracted to clean energy for, I think, a reason most of us are. It's just amazing, the idea that we can get energy from the sun, energy from the wind. Why would we be burning coal and oil when the sun is there and the wind is already there? But I really didn't get inspired until my job was to use advanced technology on the grid in San Diego to be able to accept more renewable energy. Because once you get past a certain point, it's tricky. You need to start using some software and some hardware that's a little bit different. We called it the smart grid. So I was able to help move that forward in San Diego. But that just made me learn more about what could be done that I wasn't doing. And after a few years of it, I did feel that I had to devote more of my time to it, that it was too important a mission to just do it when it was convenient as part of my job. And I wanted to put more time in. So I'm a good yapper. I have the gift of gab. And I understand,
as most Brooklyn people do, by the way.
Yes, it's a Brooklyn thing. Yes. And I understood the energy industry very well. I understood renewables well, the grid well, and software, because my background is in computer science. So I was able to put it all together, put my ability to communicate in with that, and podcast is what I came up with.
Well, that's why the kids keep leaving the lights on, because they're like protesting. No, I'm just joking.
They're out of the house now. One of them actually works in Manhattan.
Oh, awesome.
It's pretty exciting. She came back. Yeah. Do you have anything else that you'd like to add?
In terms of next steps and about how we get to a clean energy future in New York, we have just passed the CCPA, the Climate and Community Protection Act, but we still have some other things that we're going to need to do. I know I spoke a little bit about the work that we need to do around charging stations as we look to get away from fossil fuels is our fuel for vehicles in the state and retrofitting buildings, as well as teaching demand response and time of use to our citizens in the state. But we also really need to do something around, just like we have REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which is a multi-state initiative that caps, you know, is cap and trade program, but just deals with utilities. Our next step is really going to need to be a carbon pricing program. And you're seeing that conversation happen around the country, where we're essentially going to have to set the market around carbon and create a market and make it just too expensive for people to use. And I think that's really, really important. I have the bill in the Senate that would do that. Really going to be probably my number one priority coming into the next legislative session is making sure that carbon pricing gets done so that we create economic disincentive for people to continue to use fossil fuels and continue to dirty our planet and our atmosphere.
And on that note, I'm going to wrap this up, and I'm going to do it with a rap. Compared to San Diego, New York is chillery. You did the listening tour and learned a lot from Hillary. You started out learning about conservation and eventually moved on to climate change mitigation. You're really into a clean economy and you want to get there with clean energy. There's climate impact. That's a fact. With regards to actions, think globally, but locally act. We have to remember we share the same red plasma, so we've got to act on clusters of cancer and asthma. I want to take this time to shout out loud that I'm sure your mom and dad would be proud. Climate on the national agenda would be sweet. It would make the NYCCPA obsolete. You certainly inspired the best of me, and you certainly are a son of destiny. I'm glad that you are starting task forces, because air and water are important resources. It's great that in 2003 you won the vote, because even though we came from different places, we're all on the same boat.
Wow. A man of many talents. we're gonna try to see if we can sign you to a good little deal. Lee, thank you very much for the opportunity. Really enjoyed it.
First, thank you, Senator, for being so gracious. I had non-recoverable recording issues, and he extended our time so that we could complete our conversation. We were 30 minutes into our discussion when I realized the problem, and Senator Parker calmly said, "Let's start again." I was not calm. I loved going down memory lane with regard to Brooklyn, hearing about the senator's focus on all his constituents, his father's and mother's perseverance in their careers, and of course, his strong focus on climate change mitigation, resulting in the passage of New York's Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act in June of 2019. If you have comments or questions about the podcast, visit my website at www.crivatenergyinnovations.com and drop me an email. I would love to hear from you. And if you're enjoying the Climate Champions podcast series, please subscribe, rate it 5 stars if you're an Apple user, and tell your climate-concerned friends about it. And if you're in San Diego and want to trade your concern about climate change for a few hours of some great laughs, most weekends I'm doing improv comedy at either the Old Town Improv Company or Finest City Improv, or both. Contact me to confirm specific show dates. And if you want to release from some of life's stress or to improve your speaking skills, consider taking an improv workshop at a club in your town. One of my favorite moments from our discussion was when Senator Parker discussed teaching behavioral change to our children in school. Given my years in the industry, I've had my doubts about people's willingness to change how and when they use energy. But the senator's right. Looking back on the change efforts that have been successful, starting with our children and having them lead the way at home has been much more effective than the other way around, and it's a more effective way of helping to mitigate climate change.